Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We had some homes completely inundated with water. Other homes were actually lifted off their foundation and basically washed down river.
Ice jams bring serious flooding to communities along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 15th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a new vaccine could help prevent a virus that has hit residents in the YK Delta especially hard.
In particular, the YK Delta has some of the highest rates of severe RSV in the world, really, but certainly in the United States.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers an education as an adventure in living and learning. Students are the core of APU, representing the aspirations and collective wisdom of our community. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Alaska's Indigenous heritage while offering a unique and powerful educational experience. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ice on Alaska rivers is breaking up and causing jams in some locations, notably in the eastern interior and western Alaska. That means active flooding in some places and warnings about possible flooding in others. Governor Mike Dunleavy today issued a state disaster declaration for communities on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers that will make them eligible for financial assistance later. But here now to tell us about what's going on with high water around the state, as of this afternoon at least, is meteorologist Mike Ottenweller with the Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center. Mike, let's start with the eastern interior. What's going on there?
So we've kind of been thinking that Eagle might be a potential spot, a hot spot, if you will, that would see some jamming. As we got into Friday and Saturday, that's when we did see some ice jam up just downstream of Eagle. And it backed up a fairly significant ways, which allowed the water then to start to rise in Eagle. Eagle itself, I think, actually did okay. They did have some minor flooding, but all in all, that was really kind of the start of things to come. Once that breakup started to move past Eagle, which was early Saturday, the next community on the Yukon was Circle. It was overnight Saturday night that we started to hear reports from our Riverwatch team and from the state that water was indeed rising and rising fairly quickly through Saturday evening. And then overnight, Saturday night was the worst of the high water into Circle. And that's when we saw things basically crest in that area with water reaching major flood level and potentially setting the all-time historic mark for that community. There was significant damage that was reported out of Circle. We had some homes completely inundated with water. Other homes were actually lifted off their foundation and basically washed down river a good ways, and certainly plenty of other structures, you know, recreational cabins and things like that, that were inundated and effectively destroyed.
Of course, the Yukon River continues on down from there, and we're sitting here on Monday talking about this. What's the situation now, you know, downriver from Eagle and Circle?
Yeah, so we did see some signs of minor flooding down further downstream on Sunday and overnight last night, Sunday into Monday, near Fort Yukon. At this time, Fort Yukon continues to remain under a flood warning. And then we've also, just in the last little bit here, issued a flood warning for Stevens Village as well. There's a pretty significant, basically bank-to-bank section of ice that is now upstream of Stevens Village. We think that it has cleared Beaver, but it is still yet to come, obviously, for Stevens Village downstream a little bit farther. So that is the area that we're targeting now as this kind of breakup jam, if you will, the breakup front moves further downstream. It's Stevens Village that we think is the next one. And then, of course, we'll just keep going down from there and keeping an eye on communities as we go, looking down towards, you know, basically the Rampart area and then eventually towards the middle Yukon where we get towards Tanana and things like that.
Mike, we're also talking about Western Alaska, and of course, for a lot of places, that means the Kuskokwim River. And what's the situation there?
Yeah. While the Yukon has been pretty rough start, the Kuskokwim has also had its fair share of dynamic breakup. Kind of similar timing, still very late compared to normal. We would normally see like Crooked Creek break up on the 4th of May, and here we are in the middle of May talking about it. Saturday night is when we saw significant river rises for the community of Crooked Creek. That was our first really big impact. Red Devil did also have some river rises and some, minor flooding and minor impacts. But it was really Crooked Creek that saw the most significant flooding in the past couple of days. We were talking about water going into the second story of some homes. All the roads were impassable by vehicle, and so folks out there were, gathering together as a community and using boats to make sure that everybody was safe. And they took refuge inside the school there. But we also have reports of potentially even people sleeping in their boats overnight. And really just doing whatever they could to avoid those waters, especially, in the dark period of the day, where it can be even more hazardous to try to navigate what's going on with an ice jam.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty sketchy situation. Again, I mean, are there places farther down river that you're looking at today that have the potential to flood, that maybe have flood watches in effect?
Yeah, so there's kind of a bad news, good news for the Kuskokwim. So leading with the bad news is kind of the more forefront of our concerns right now. We have a flood warning out for Napaimute, and that stretches all the way down and into Aniak. And so that's our area of concern right now. The good news, though, is that once we get past that Aniak area and downstream, we're starting to see a lot more open water from tributaries that come in from some of the sloughs and the feeder networks into the main river stem. And so that is helping to break up the ice in advance of this breakup front. And so we really have increasing confidence that once the breakup jam gets past Aniak, that we should see things clear out pretty effectively. That's not to say that all those communities are totally out of the woods, but it's looking much more open downstream of Aniak than it was, for any of those areas upstream there.
And then what about Glen Allen? I've heard that there's some flooding going on in Glen Allen, but it's like it's a different cause and maybe not as bad, but what's going on there?
Certainly, a lot of snow across the state in general. We were either at average or above average for most of the locations in terms of snowpack, and Glen Allen was no exception. The Copper River Basin was above average. With all that water and given the delayed kind of snow melt spring start that we had this year with such a cold April, that really allowed that snow to hold in place. And now that we're starting to see temperatures normal for middle of May, with that, the snow is just really rapidly melting. All that snow fed into Moose Creek over the weekend, and that then led to Moose Creek kind of getting swollen and pushing out of its banks. And that's what has now pushed into the Glen Allen area and over top of the Glen Highway, of course.
Well, Mike, I should ask. I mean, you mentioned some damage to, structures earlier, but have you heard anything about, loss of life or injuries, from this flooding?
Actually, no, we haven't. That's probably one of the things that we just really are proud and happy to hear that, and that the communities were prepared and able to work together to help each other out. Because certainly there were, some harrowing moments and whatnot, and I'm sure more stories will come out. But it sounds like all the evacuations that took place were just, on the local level and just getting out of harm's way, in the immediate time frame. So we're very happy to hear that and hope that continues to be the case through the rest of the spring breakup season.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you helping get the word out too. That was Mike Ottenweller with the Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center. Mike, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
U.S. fighter jets intercepted six Russian aircraft flying off Alaska's coasts again last week and accompanied them as they passed through the international airspace. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The North American Aerospace Defense Command says its Alaska NORAD region office detected, identified, and tracked the Russian aircraft that were flying through the Alaska Air Defense Identification Zone on Thursday. A NORAD news release issued Saturday says the Russian formation included Tu-95 bombers, Su-35 fighters, and an air refueling tanker. In response, Alaska NORAD dispatched F-16 and F-22 fighter jets and an AWACS plane plane for what the agency called a routine interception. But the news release didn't say where the intercept occurred, nor how many U.S. aircraft were dispatched to accompany the Russian planes through the aircraft ID zone. NORAD officials routinely don't provide more information than released, and didn't again on Sunday. It's not unusual for Russian aircraft to fly through the Alaska Air ID zone, which is international airspace. NORAD says the Russian aircraft didn't enter U.S. or Canadian airspace and weren't considered a threat to either nation. But some observers noted the interception occurred while a large-scale military training exercise called Northern Edge is being conducted around Alaska, and while the U.S. and NATO are supporting Ukraine in its fight against the Russian invasion. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Legislature honors Filipino-American contributions in Alaska.
Filipino-Americans are part of the fabric of Alaska's diverse history.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
The Alaska Senate unanimously passed a bill today that would allow the state to develop land that it would sell for carbon credits. Carbon credits are sold to those looking to offset their greenhouse gas emissions, including Fortune 500 companies under pressure from shareholders. Several companies in Alaska are selling carbon credits by managing existing privately owned forests to capture and store more carbon dioxide. The new bill charges the Department of Natural Resources to do the same thing on state-owned land. State Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, told the Senate the bill is in line with the Constitution's mandate to use resources to the maximum benefit of Alaskans. He said the program would not affect people's ability to use state forests for hunting, camping, or fishing, and he said it doesn't block resource development.
This is the state responding to a need that exists in the free market. This is not a cap-and-trade program. We are not putting any emissions limits on anyone.
It's not clear how much money the program could earn in state revenue. Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration originally estimated carbon sequestration could bring in billions of dollars. In more recent committee meetings, a consultant estimated revenue in the tens of millions of dollars for three pilot projects. Department of Natural Resources Commissioner John Boyle says he hopes the program could start generating revenue in the next few years.
This is a huge step. I mean, we're very excited to see unanimous approval of the bill, and we think that that bodes well for passage in the House as well.
House leaders have expressed support for the bill, but it faces a tight timeline to pass it before the end of the regular session on Wednesday. The legislature passed a bill Friday officially establishing the month of October as Filipino American History Month in state statute. Anchorage Democratic Representative Genevieve Mina introduced the bill. She's Alaska's second ever Filipino legislator elected last fall.
The overwhelming support that we've seen for this bill is just a testament to how, not ubiquitous, but just how present Filipinos are in all of our different communities.
The bill had widespread support with 43 sponsors. Senator L.V. Gray Jackson, also an Anchorage Democrat, brought the bill to the Senate floor on Friday.
From seasonal migrant canary workers to health care workers and political leaders, Filipino Americans are part of the fabric of Alaska's diverse history. Unfortunately, the history of the Filipino community is not often told, which results in the erasure of both the history of this community and the people themselves.
In 2019, two bills establishing February as Black History Month and November as Alaska Native Heritage Month were signed into law. Senator Jackson says she sees HB 23 as an addition to these efforts to recognize the diverse cultures of Alaska in state statute. The bill now goes to Governor Mike Dunleavy to be signed into law. The Food and Drug Administration recently approved a new vaccine for the respiratory virus RSV. This could be life-changing for many people, especially those living in rural Alaska. According to the CDC, RSV leads to as many as 160,000 hospitalizations of elderly people in the United States each year. KYUK's Evan Erickson spoke with doctors on the front lines of RSV treatment in Alaska and has this story about the long-awaited breakthrough.
Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, has been a fact of life for decades in the United States and is the leading cause of respiratory infections in infants and children worldwide. Now, FDA approval of GSK's Arexv vaccine, the first of its kind, has given medical professionals in Alaska new hope for dealing with the virus.
They've been working on this vaccine since the 1960s.
That's Michelle Nace, a Fairbanks-based pediatrician and staff physician with the Alaska Department of Health.
So getting this first vaccine approval by FDA earlier this month was a phenomenally like, okay, we are there. We are going to be able to help these people.
While for most people, RSV symptoms can be likened to the common cold, the virus can be deadly for the very young and very old, especially premature infants and adults 65 years and older. According to the CDC, there are as many as 10,000 RSV-related deaths among the elderly in the U.S. every year. Nace said the new vaccine, for use in adults 60 and older, is only the first step in the fight against RSV.
As we know from what we learned through COVID, it is easier to test on adults and older people than it is to test on pregnant and infants. So we tend to see these vaccines come out first in that age group, but in the works and the pipeline are also these vaccines for pregnant people as well as infants.
Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation Chief of Staff Dr. Ellen Hodges said the potential benefits of the vaccine go beyond preventing severe RSV infections in the elderly.
There was a period of time when our elders could be vaccinated against pneumococcal disease, and we didn't yet have an approved vaccine for children. And it did start to reduce the rates of pneumococcal disease among children as well. So we're hoping that by vaccinating our elders, we can have a twofold effect by protecting our elders against severe disease, but also hopefully protecting our most vulnerable babies as well.
According to Dr. Hodges, the rate of hospitalization for RSV is 5 times greater among Alaska Native children than for the U.S. as a whole.
In particular, the YK Delta has some of the highest rates of severe RSV in the world, really, but certainly in the United States. So much so that there is a book called The Red Book, which is published by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it's about infectious disease. And the YK Delta merits a special comment in that book because of our severity and amount of RSV that we have in our region.
Dr. Hodges hopes Arexv will be fully approved soon.
And I was actually just talking with the state, and it has a possibility of being approved by the ACIP, which is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, with the CDC as soon as this week. So we could potentially be able to order that sometime in the very near future.
This means the vaccine could be available in time for rollout in Alaska in the YK Delta in the fall, when the first cases of RSV are commonly seen. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Nome's shelter for people experiencing a lack of housing closed for the season last week. That meant as many as 50 unhoused individuals were looking for a place to stay. KNOM's Greg Knight reports.
The shelter is called The Nest, which stands for Nome Emergency Shelter Team. It's been a resource for the unhoused in Nome throughout the winter. Each night, according to Janice Miksuk of the Nome Community Center, the unhoused are sheltered and fed at the Nest facility. The Nest is operated by the Community Center and is open to patrons each year from November to May. It also opens when temperatures reach minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit at night. But now, with the annual closure, many will likely sleep outdoors if they have nowhere else to go. Mick Souk is the community outreach coordinator at the center and helps lead the effort at the shelter.
They do sleep under buildings. Under buildings, abandoned buildings. There are some spots along the seawall that they'll crawl into and sleep.
A man we'll call Ollie is one of the patrons who utilizes the shelter in the winter. He says he is going to end up sleeping in a vehicle this spring and summer, and he's not looking forward to what comes next.
We're all going to be sleeping outside. Every single one of us going to be sleeping outside. It is going to be tough for all of us.
Nome Police Chief Mike Heinzelman says if an unhoused individual is found sleeping on private property, like houses or abandoned buildings that don't belong to them, they could be cited.
We would have to treat every scenario on its own merit. Whether or not someone gets cited for that would all depend on the individuals and how many times they've been there and the situation, etc.
Heinzelman says his officers consider the level of intoxication of individuals when assessing if they should be jailed for trespassing rather than cited. He says taking individuals to the hospital rather than jail will be how the department responds if the individuals are highly intoxicated.
If they're that high of intoxication level, the jail wouldn't even take them. And it's a situation that needs to be treated medically.
Mick Souk says that although the Nest shelter is closing, the unhoused in Nome will still have use of the day shelter near the hospital. The unhoused can also go to the Nome Food Bank on Tuesdays and Thursdays to receive non-perishable items. She adds that every individual that is unhoused in Nome is a person and not just a statistic, and that they all have a story to tell.
They are people, and they do have their own stories. And there are some that like to tell their stories. And it's really great to hear some of them. It's really sad to hear some of them, but they are people.
The shelter is scheduled to reopen in November. Reporting in Nome, I'm Greg Knight.
Fans of the TV drama Alaska Daily will never know if Eileen Fitzgerald, a hard-nosed hotshot reporter, will fall in love with a bush pilot and put down roots in Alaska, or what's behind her panic attacks. ABC has canceled the series after only one season. Hilary Swank played Fitzgerald, who had come to Alaska to redeem her reputation after she left a New York City newspaper in disgrace. A former editor recruited her to help investigate a series of cold cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous women. Eileen was neither impressed with the Alaska Daily, which operated out of a strip mall in Anchorage, nor the reporter she was paired up with, Roz Friendly, an Alaska native and one of the newspaper's rising stars, played by Grace Dove.
Roz, I want to put you on a story with Eileen.
Another missing, murdered Native woman.
And we need to show who's to blame.
I work alone. Do you know anything about Alaska? She always liked this?
Roz and Eileen eventually worked together to solve the murder of a young Native woman and learn from each other in the process. In the last show, Eileen turns down a job in New York and decides to stay in Alaska, at least for the time being. Vera Starbard, an Alaska native and one of the writers for the series, says she had hoped to expand Roz's role to reveal more about her culture and family background.
Honestly, she's the reason I signed on to the show. Like, okay, here's a real Alaska Native character. This isn't some silent nobody who's going to get two lines, but who's really going to sort of fight for her own space and fight for her right to be there.
Starbird says Roz and Eileen were pivotal characters who helped to raise awareness about the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous people.
Literally, millions of people who saw the show now have to know this is an issue, and many of them are a little bit more educated on exactly why that's an issue.
Some of the storylines for Alaska Daily were inspired by the work of Kyle Hopkins, an Anchorage Daily News reporter, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his series Lawless, Sexual Violence in Alaska. Starbard says the true crime element was an important undercurrent in the show, though she and one of her co-writers, Andrew McLean, a filmmaker from Utqiagvik, worked to keep Alaska Daily from becoming too sensational. Starbard says they also tried hard to make the show as authentically Alaskan as possible. She says one of their big successes was getting Native languages incorporated into the script. Also, the Alaska Native characters wore clothing, jewelry, and regalia made by Alaska Natives. Starbird says she's disappointed but not surprised the ABC network canceled the program. It was an expensive show to produce and did not draw the ratings the network had hoped for. Starbird says she wrote the 11th and final episode, leaving the show with a feeling that there was so much more to share about the richness and beauty of Alaska's indigenous cultures. Well, Kodiak Island is home to a burgeoning local food movement, one that could get a whole lot bigger this summer thanks to one gardener's ambitious plan to plant 500,000 carrots across the archipelago. KMXD's Kirsten Dobroth has the story.
You could say Dave Jackson is Kodiak's carrot kingpin. Jackson's got a thriving garden at his house on the sunny side of Bell's Flats, just past Kodiak's Coast Guard base. There's onions and asparagus and rhubarb and beds of greens. But carrots are the main attraction.
Three out of these four beds right in front here is where I'm going to grow carrots. And I grow quite a few carrots. I give a lot away. I probably put 2,000 seeds in there.
That might seem like a lot of carrots, but it pales in comparison to Jackson's bigger goal for this summer, to distribute 1,000 growing kits, each containing hundreds of carrot seeds, to gardeners across the island.
The goal is to put 500,000 seeds out there and try to get people to plant them.
But Jackson says the plan started off much smaller. One of his friends asked if he could put together a carrot planting packet to give to the neighborhood kids who kept eating carrots out of his garden. So he posted on Facebook to ask if other people wanted their own packets too.
It got like 150 hits right off the bat. I went, whoa. Next day I ordered this bucket of seeds.
Jackson worked as a fisherman and then for Alaska's Department of Fish and Game for 3 decades. He says carrots are perfect for commercial fishing communities like Kodiak. You can leave them for weeks at a time, which is especially convenient with salmon season on the horizon.
I learned how to do these carrots high intensity, low maintenance. I do no thinning and no weeding. And so once I get the carrots up a couple of inches, I can go away and go fishing or whatever and come back in 6 weeks and start eating carrots.
Each carrot kit comes with an envelope filled with 500 seeds and everything you need to plant them. Jackson says the kits are perfect for aspiring or established gardeners, and they're available for free at locations around Kodiak. He's not shipping the kits outside Kodiak, but they have made it to other parts of the state, including Homer and the Aleutian Chain. He says he doesn't have a long-term goal for the project, just that at least this summer, it means more locally grown food will end up on people's plates.
I really don't have a way to judge how effective we are, you know, scientifically or anything, but I'm expecting there's going to be lots of carrots.
Jackson's advice is to plant by mid-May to have carrots in time for fall. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Lex Trinan and Tasha Elizarde in Juneau, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Greg Knight in Nome, Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, and Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.